Hey, everybody. If you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
Hey, everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace, because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now, and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF, and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and Jerry's here too. And this is Stuff You Should Know, Postmodernism Edition.
I'm strapping on my ice skates.
I know. Chuck, I was thinking about it. This may very well be the most difficult topic we've ever tackled.
Is this hard for you too?
Oh, yeah. It's hard for everybody. It's hard for everyone.
Oh, good.
It's very difficult. It's really hard to define. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to mischaracterize things as postmodern and lump stuff in, even though it is technically that. And worst of all, it's really easy for people to be snobby to other people about what is or isn't postmodernism. So it's going to be rough.
I think that's why I'm a little, not nervous, because who really cares, right? It's just a podcast. but unnerved, because philosophical movements, art movements that have fuzzy boundaries, mm-hmm. It's tough for me, always has been. I deal a little bit more in the concrete.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to be interesting, especially when, you look at some more, I don't know about cynical, but just sort of straightforward definitions of, like, what is postmodern art, and most people will say, like, well, it's art that happened between 1955 and 1970 and right now.
Wrong.
Well, it's not wrong. It's an era. Like, that's where it gets slippery.
Right.
Because art is defined by eras. And even though people did things in the different eras that thematically and stylistically apply more to other eras, mm-hmm. Would you call The Godfather a postmodern film? No, but it was made in the postmodern film era.
Precisely. So the differentiation here then is that it begins. The differentiation here is the postmodernism that we're talking about is not just art. It's not just film. It's not just architecture. It's not even just philosophy. We're talking about an entire worldview that all of us collectively share. Most of us, I should say. I think, the West, you could say, if you want to call it that, shares this culture, postmodernist culture.
Post-World War II, generally.
Yeah, some people put it at the 70s, some people put it at the 60s, other people even go as late as, like, basically 1979, 1980. But it's not just an art movement. It's not just a type of film. It's not just a type of literature. It's a way of looking at the world that in turn shapes how we create or exist or live in or deal with the world. And we do it together. It's culture. But the reason it's so fuzzy, Chuck, compared to other things, is because it may still be going on right now. And if it isn't still going on right now, it ended so recently that we're still so wrapped up in the turbulent effects of it that it's hard to see which way's up, down, sideways. So it's really difficult to nail down. But it's really fun to try, I've found.
And it's the kind of thing where, like, they probably won't put a year marker until 30 years from now on what postmodernism is, which we'll get to.
Yeah, totally.
And even then, it's not a cut and dried thing, because a change like this happens over the course of a decade or two.
Yeah, or more even, for sure.
More.
And I would posit that we're in those decades of change right now. We're in a transition period between postmodernism and what's next. I think that's one reason why everything is just so uncomfortable right now, in addition to a pandemic being dropped on top of us at a really uncomfortable time.
And I would also say, after reading a lot about this stuff, I think art, visual art, like, let's just say painting.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a lot more to it than that, but as opposed to literature and film, mm-hmm. I think the boundaries there are a little more rigid than in things like literature and film,
yeah.
where they draw demarcation lines between pre-modern, modern, and postmodern eras mm-hmm. a little more succinctly. Like, technically, anything made these days would be considered postmodern art, just by the virtue of the fact that it's now, whereas you would not say a film is necessarily.
Right, right, right.
I quit.
No, you did great. We're doing great. Just hang in there, man. Just double up the strength of your fingernails and claw in further, okay?
Because I just feel the emails being typed.
It's fine. You know what? We could go super postmodern and just totally ignore them like they don't exist. Because what is really an email? You know what I mean?
Yeah, or we could, a really postmodern email reply would be, you know, I read your email and here's what I think, and just stop at THIN.
Yeah, that's pretty great. That would be great. So this is going to be fun. We're talking about postmodernism, and this is one of those things where we have to define it from the outset, which is the problem with postmodernism is figuring out how to define it. And before we go any further, every hat I own right now, I'm taking off for Dave Roos, who helped us put this together.
He did a great job.
He did a wonderful job.
Like, it was not fair to throw this at him.
No, I was really interested to see what he would do, and he did. He really rose to the occasion.
I agree.
A great job.
Smashing
so,
job.
He kind of started with this anecdote about a student of an art professor who asked his class, like, you know, what is postmodernism? How do you define it? And the student said basically something that the professor later ripped off, which is, it's where you put quotations around everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost feels cynical in a way.
Yes. 100%.
Doesn't it?
1,000,000%. Like the age of cynicism. Remember the sarcasm of the 90s?
Mm-hmm. That went away.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You
exactly.
just did it. So all of that is 100% the fabric, the cultural fabric of postmodernism. It's as we'll see, a tearing down, not just institutions and authorities and all that stuff, but other people. Just doing it as like just the most casual thing in the world, just tearing down. That is the cultural basis of postmodernism.
Yeah, like if someone were to talk about Andy Warhol's soup cans, they can say, well, that's his truth in reality, but you would put that in quotes.
Right.
With your hands at a party.
You put truth in quotes, you put reality in quotes,
yeah.
And that's what that student was saying. You put everything in quotes because the philosophical basis of postmodernism is that there is no such thing as universal truth. There's no such thing as reality. Like your reality.
You could put soup cans in quotes.
You could. You could even, if you wanted to be a total jerk, you could do soup in quotes and cans in quotes.
And Andy Warhol in quotes.
Right. So, and Andy Warhol would love it. He would roll over in his grave, but it'd be like a dance move more than something out of agony. You know? So that's kind of what the student was saying. You put everything in quotes because there is no universal truth. And mm-hmm. that is where postmodernism broke from its immediate predecessor, which is modernism, which said, no, there's all sorts of universal truths. And that carried on an even longer tradition of the idea that there's universal truths and we can try to find these through different ways.
Right. And with modernism, it was like, let's not use religion, let's use reason. And it's like a post-Enlightenment sort of frame of mind.
Yeah.
Where we can figure out these universal truths and we can apply them to our artworks, whether it's literature or, you know, any kind of visual art.
Right. Right. So with modern art, as weird as it can seem, as abstract as it can seem, what they were doing really ultimately at base followed in the tradition of like the Romanticists before them, of the Renaissance painters before them. They were all trying to move toward what's called sublime sensibility, which is this idea that there is a universal truth. There is universal beauty. There is universal like happiness. The nature is a universal. It's shared and common to all people. It exists in and of itself. And they just kind of chose a different way of going after that rather than painting like cherubs and the most amazing clouds you can possibly come up with, you know, behind the crucifixion of Christ or something. They tried to evoke it through those shapes and colors and abstract paintings. But they were still at base after the same thing, which was uncovering that universal truth of like beauty.
Right. And then, you know, we talked about it before, I took a philosophy class in college that both blew my mind and I just didn't even understand, but I tried. Uh-huh. I think I actually made an A in it because I tried really, really, really hard in that class.
Nice.
No, kids, I tried hard in every class.
That's right.
But especially hard in philosophy. But I remember studying Nietzsche and some of it hitting home a little bit in that even though Nietzsche was for sure like postmodernism as far as an era is defined, but had these thoughts of postmodernism in that Nietzsche came along and said, you know what, there are perspectives. There is not a universal truth because we are all individuals and we all have our own unique perspective on what beauty might be or what truth might be or reality might be. Mm-hmm. So that I remember that speaking to me some more than, I guess, the modernist thought.
Yeah, because it makes sense. It's that whole kind of thing, like, what is the color green to you? It's not the same to me. Or if you look at an apple on a table and then you move around the table, the apple changes shape. So depending literally on your perspective, you see things differently. And so what Nietzsche was saying is that if you take that and multiply it by however many billion people are on the planet— mm-hmm. How can there possibly be such a thing as a shared reality? How can there possibly be such a thing as a universal truth? There can't. It's just not possible because not only do people see things differently, they have different experiences in their lives that alter perception even more minutely. It's just too complex. Humans and then collectively humanity is too complex to have universal truths. And so that was kind of the basis of his perspectivism that you were talking about. And then in turn, by proxy, he said, well, then that means that all of these meta-narratives, the stories that we tell ourselves, they're meaningless. They can't be true either.
Yeah, so what postmodernism would end up becoming is a rejection of modernism, and that would play out across all kinds of different kind of art forms that we're going to talk about in a little bit, mm-hmm. but philosophically as well, because if science and reason bring us world war and nuclear bombs, then there's going to be, I think, a tendency to reject that.
Yeah. So kind of like, I think we talked about it before, I don't remember in what episode, but that World War I was like, it revealed the full horror of just putting all of your faith in science and reason, that like it would lead to technology that led to destruction. And then that was followed up by World War II and the Holocaust. It was followed up by things like lobotomies and phrenology and just mass destruction, the nuclear bomb. All this stuff came from the application of science and reason faithfully, unerringly. And so postmodernism said, you know, we need to get rid of this completely and totally. We need to tear it all down and start over. So the whole movement started out as a response, a reactionary response to the horrors of a different movement. And I think anytime you have a movement that's born out of a repellent response to something,
yeah,
it's going to be reckless. And I think in that sense, postmodernism is and always has been reckless because, again, it's all about tearing down. And it started with tearing down all of the pillars and the golden calves of modernism.
Well, reckless or free?
Both. It's definitely both.
All right.
I think it's very much both because I think, you know, as we'll see later on, postmodernism ultimately led to its own horrors that we're living with today. And it was out of recklessness, I think.
Okay.
Are you
talking about the digital age?
That's part of it for sure.
Should we take a break?
I think your dog says so.
Did you hear that? It is National Pet Day.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Hey, everybody, if you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. You start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.
All right, we're back. My dog barked again to signal us. And I guess we should just go ahead and say that the term itself, postmodernism, was coined by a French philosopher named Jean-François. How would you pronounce that? Is it Lyotard?
Lyotard or Lyotard.
Okay. And this was in 1979. So, you know, people put the postmodern era again, there are fuzzy numbers, but I've generally mostly seen sort of mid-1950s to early 1970s is kind of the beginning.
Right.
And so this was in 1979 when it was actually defined by Jean-Francois, who said, "I define postmodern as incredulity toward meta-narratives," mm-hmm. Which you already talked about, these sort of stories that we tell ourselves that sort of give structure to all of our existence.
Yeah, it's like I saw it explained as a meta-narrative is the blueprint that we carry out like our actions and our lives in. So that like without a blueprint, a plumber just laying pipe is just randomly laying pipe. There's no point or reason to what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But if they're following a blueprint, it gives their work meaning, guidance. There's a purpose to it. And so meta-narratives can take all sorts of different forms, from the free market is going to deliver us all to like this prosperous, happy, progressive future, to religion explains why we're here, to basically any grand story that's like the big picture, that's a meta-narrative. And we've got a lot of them. And postmodernism said not a single one of those is legitimate.
Well, I don't know about legitimate, but not a single one of those should be looked at as the truth.
Okay.
Like, I think they can be considered. But the problem, I think, with modernism, or at least as far as a postmodernist goes, is that they laid claim that these are the universal truths.
Okay. I think that was a very important nuance point that you're right.
All right.
I retract my original statement.
Okay.
We need a ding, chuck, right. 1 point.
Oh, that'll be my only ding.
I don't know, man. You've been dinging it up already. I just haven't used the sound effect.
Okay. But it's, we talked about cynicism. It's also about skepticism, right?
Yeah. So I think that's part of the sarcasm and the irony. When you are sarcastic towards somebody, when you're ironic about, when you speak ironically about something, you're expressing skepticism that what that is true or cool or real or anything, whatever it is you're saying, as long as it's sarcastic or ironic, it's a form of skepticism. And that is kind of like the hallmark cultural move.
I think hallmark is good.
Okay, that's the cultural hallmark of postmodernism, I think. Irony and skepticism and sarcasm.
Okay, I agree with all that.
Ding.
Ding. Or we need Chris Hardwick on here just to say points.
Oh, that's a good one.
He what's he doing these days? He could probably do that.
I think he's still doing the Talking Dead.
No, I'm sure he does plenty.
Yeah.
He's a Brandon to himself.
Yeah, he's like the Ryan Seacrest of podcasting.
That's sure. He probably podcasts too, though.
Probably, but I think Chris Hardwick is still the Ryan Seacrest of podcasting.
Should we talk about art, like painting and stuff?
Yeah, because I think we laid the groundwork here, but let's just go over this real quick one more time. Postmodernism is a recoil, repellent response to modernism, which produced all sorts of world wars and the nuclear bomb, and was based on authority figures and rigidity and universal truths, and you have to follow this, and you have to look at this way, and if you paint a different way outside of that, it's not really art. And the art world was one of the very first outside of philosophy to kind of rebel against that. The idea that there's anybody who could say that's art, that's not art. And one of the first people to really do that was the Dadaist Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah, so here's the thing with talking about eras of art. If you look at some of Duchamp's work, in particular, we should just go ahead and reference probably one of the most famous, which was what he called a ready-made, which mm-hmm. was to take, in this case, a urinal, not built a urinal, but take a mass-produced urinal, mm-hmm. signed a name on it, a pen name in this case was R. Mutt, M-U-T-T, and it called it Fountain in 1917. And right. This was a piece of art. And if you look at this piece of art, it is decidedly postmodern. But it was made, 5 to 6 decades before anyone would define art as postmodern art. And it lives like squarely in the middle. I don't know about the middle, but it lives squarely in the modern art movement. Mm-hmm. So like the difference between, and I read a lot about this, between modern art and postmodern art is philosophical. It's also like cultural, in that it was mainly men who were making the art. The postmodern art really brought along different cultural perspectives and female perspectives. Mm-hmm. It was also, I read, very goal-oriented, whereas postmodern art cared more about process. Apparently, modern art was very much still goal-oriented, even though they saw it as a rejection of the still life of the bowl of fruit on the table before mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work still sort of echoed that kind of thing. And then you have Duchamp coming along with his toilet, which is completely postmodern, but lives in a modern era.
Right. And like you were saying, like he came decades before the postmodern era in exactly the same way that Nietzsche was laying the foundation for postmodernism sure. and philosophy and culture decades before the postmodern era too, even further back than that. But there's just no way of looking at Duchamp's work any other way than this is a postmodern artwork. And not just that one, The Fountain. Like, that was his, like, bread and butter, was using these ready-mades. And that was a huge foundation of the actual postmodern art movement that came later, which was, first of all, tearing down the distinction between high art and low art, because Duchamp was a serious artist exhibiting in serious galleries and museums and things like that. But he was also buying urinals, signing them, and calling it art. So in one way, that makes it, like, way more accessible to you and me. It makes it less scary. Like, art's less scary. You don't have to be an expert to come into the art world now and appreciate art or laugh at art or take your, you know, let the art, you know, like, stop taking life quite so seriously. But at the same time, it also, the fact that he went and bought something, he paid for something from a plumbing supply company that was mass-produced, also laid the foundation for guys later like Andy Warhol, who melded consumerism into art to create pop culture, which opened the door for commoditization of art, which then opened the door for what we live in today, which is, like, art is advertising, basically. Like, there's almost no distinction whatsoever. It's everywhere, and it's hijacked to sell things as much as it is to actually make art or make something beautiful or good or thought-provoking.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that the transition to postmodern art is really interesting because it opened it to different classes. Modern art was almost exclusively based in Europe and Russia, I guess, whereas postmodern art, after World War II, things really you could say all of the West basically was taking part. But just sort of outsider art and conceptual art and to things where we have today, we're like, well, someone will put a pile of sunflower seeds in the middle of a floor and call it art. Mm-hmm. That is the postmodern sort of rejection of what was already, I think, a pretty radical departure as far as the art world is concerned with modern art. Because when you have people like Jackson Pollock or, you know, Picasso or the Cubist stuff, there was already, I think a lot of that stuff was a little bit slower to accept from sort of the traditional, you know, pre-modern art critics.
Right.
So postmodern just blew past it.
It definitely did. And then, so Warhol comes along and creates pop art, and everybody starts definitely riffing on that vibe. But one of the other hallmarks of postmodern art is borrowing and remixing, mm-hmm. mashing up other styles, other types of art from different eras, different media, and just kind of mixing it together in a brand new way. That's one of the hallmarks of postmodern art as well.
Yeah, I love that David Byrne quote you sent, because he's a sort of the quintessential postmodern musician. Mm-hmm. And he said he was all about the mashing up and the mixing up of things, and it was just sort of a really free and creative time. So he was all about it, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, especially now today, the world we live in, postmodernism has, like, a really bad name almost across the board to everybody. But there was definitely a time where it was, like, glorious and beautiful and fun. And David Byrne was definitely there for that heyday, for sure.
Can we talk about a couple of these other famous postmodern works?
Yeah.
The Treachery of Images is another one. And again, I think this was in the modern era, technically, but it was one of the first seeds of what was to come. Mm-hmm. This was from René Magritte, and it is the very famous picture of a pipe, a smoking pipe, with a caption in French. It says, "This is not a pipe," but what would that be in French, my French-speaking friend?
Ce n'est pas une pipe.
He sounded literally like the Google person on or the YouTube translator.
Josh says.
I did not know you had that as a moonlighting job.
I do, and I'm making almost no money off of it, but it's still, it's a labor of love.
But this is a great example of what was to come with postmodernism, which is, here's a picture of a pipe. It's clearly a pipe, but it says, this is not a pipe, because perspective, baby. That's not my reality. There is no objective truth.
Yeah, that's another thing that postmodernism kind of came along and warned everybody about, is us putting all of our faith and just casual trust in the images and words that we've created to create our culture, right?
Yeah.
And so Magritte was saying, and this is like quintessential postmodernism, that this is not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe. You can't trust it. You can't use it. You can't stuff it with tobacco and smoke it. Don't call it a pipe. It's not really a pipe. And that kind of like postmodern thought, where there was no real meaning to pictures, images, words, sounds, aside from what we ascribe to them,
yeah,
it kind of eventually morphed into this weird thing where we got really comfortable with that, you know, David Byrne idea of remixing everything, of using these different things and these different codes to create new meanings. But at the same time, we were simulating reality in different ways. And so eventually we started to lose the ability to distinguish between reality, like anything approaching what we would call like real reality, and simulated reality, which was all the words and images and pictures that we just kind of take for granted are real, but actually aren't. They're all just symbols that we've stopped seeing as symbols. And so what postmodernism was warning about, what Magritte was warning or kind of reminding us of, ended up subverting itself and creating an inability in us here living today to distinguish between simulated reality and real reality. Because you're a terrible example of this, but the Thank average you. Person out there, when's the last time you actually went out in the woods?
Oh, sure.
It's probably That's been a really long time. When's the last time you saw a video or an image of the woods? Mm. And to your brain, you're like, oh, yeah, I've probably been in the woods pretty recently. No, you haven't. You haven't been in the woods in years. You saw it on TV last week. That's the most recent brush with the woods that you've had. That's what has been the result of postmodernism. And it's interesting that they were originally warning about it and then came to kind of throw the shackle on all of us.
Yeah, I like this other example because I think this I think when people of the time might have seen Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe, I'm sure like your average person might just say, what are you even talking about with this?
Yeah.
Or somebody might see that today and say that. But totally. In the 60s, Dave found this other great example that very much evokes that This Is Not a Pipe work from Joseph Kosuth, One in Three Chairs. And I think this one is more likely to get through to someone who doesn't, may not typically understand this kind of philosophy, which is it's a real folding chair, and then it's flanked by a black and white photograph of that same exact folding chair, and then a placard with a dictionary definition of chair. And I think this is a little more accessible for your average Joe to maybe come up and say, oh, I get what they're doing here. Like, I might not fully understand it, but like, I see what they mean. This is a chair, and this is a chair, and this is a chair.
Plus, it's not in French.
Yeah, exactly.
It automatically makes it more accessible to the average Joe.
Yeah. How would you say that in French? Do you even know? One in three chairs?
Une chairs.
Is it chairs?
I haven't gotten to that on my YouTube channel yet. So, no, I can't remember what chair is, but I'll bet some people are going to write in and tell us.
Yeah, but you know what all of this did was, in speaking in terms of like this kind of visual art, is it opened the doors not only for different cultures and different people and different classes and races and men and women and all across the gender spectrum to open up their minds and create, but it was a lot of times it was shocking and it allowed them to really push the boundaries of what art could even be. which was a new thing.
I was reading up. Do you remember the huge controversy in the late 80s? It turned out to be 1987. I didn't remember that. But with that image, Piss Christ.
I don't remember that.
It was an enormous thing. The National Endowment of the Arts got its funding slashed as a result because it turned out, this artist, I can't remember his name, but he did a photo series of a crucifix in different body fluids, like his own blood. And then this one was submerged in his own urine. And it's actually pretty until you realize what you're looking at. And it set a lot of Christians, including Jesse Helms, off.
Yeah.
And they went crazy on the National Endowment of the Arts. This artist lost a bunch of funding.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. And it brought to the fore this kind of culture clash of no one, especially not Jesse Helms, can say what's art and what's not art. This artist has created something and he says this is art. It's art. And that in and of itself is a very postmodern way of looking at things. And also, it turned out the artist himself was like a devout Catholic. He didn't mean it blasphemously at all.
That was designed not to provoke, at all. I'm sure.
It was. I can't remember exactly what his purpose of it was, but I don't think he meant anything to happen like it happened.
Right.
But even that's just beside the point. The point was there was a fight over what's art, and, a lot of the arch conservatives won that fight by slashing the National Endowment of the Arts and giving it a bad name because it's a federally funded agency, and so taxpayer money was going into it. Taxpayers who didn't think that was art at all didn't want their money going to it. And it was quite a big kerfuffle, but it was super postmodern while it was happening.
Right. And they were like, what's wrong with a bowl of fruit on a table? Can't we just paint that forever?
Exactly.
Everyone loves the bowls of fruit.
How about some more of those Georgia O'Keeffe flowers? I love those for some reason I can't quite put my finger on.
Oh, that's funny. Should we take a break or should we talk about literature, then take a break?
That's up to you. It's up to your doggy.
All right. Nico says go forward with literature.
Okay, cool.
The modernist movement with literature featured people like Joyce and Virginia Woolf. And this is, again, sort of with modern art, boundaries were being pushed in different directions from sort of the old school of literary styles. All of a sudden you had stream of consciousness happening, nonlinear narratives happening. Mm-hmm. This is where free verse poetry was born. But then postmodernists came along and they went, oh, you think that's pushing the boundaries? let me introduce you to Thomas Pynchon and Joseph Heller and people like this who really took things to an nth degree, to the point where you found that one book that just stopped in the middle of the first chapter over and over.
Yeah, there's a book by Italo Calvino called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. It's from 1979. It's a quintessential postmodern novel in that it's written in the second person perspective. So he talks about you. So you're the main character. Mm-hmm. And it starts out by saying you are about to begin reading Italo Calvino's new novel, If on a Winter Night, a Traveler. Relax, concentrate, dispel every other thought. So the author is directing you, the reader, to begin the novel that you're reading. So you're immediately the character. Like, he's writing about you in this page.
Yeah.
And then it very quickly careens from what you would consider real. Like, the book runs out on page 32 in the book. The book you're actually reading still goes on.
Yeah.
It's just in the book that happens. So now you, the character, have to go to the bookstore and you get another version and you end up reading 10 different beginnings to the same book. But the upside of it is you fall in love with Ludmila, the bookstore shopkeeper as well. So it's completely out of left field and you could say absurd. And that is quintessentially postmodern too. James Joyce wasn't doing anything quite like that.
No, not at all. And this is where I have an appreciation for it. I think very clever. I see what you're doing there. But I would rather read a good novel from beginning to end with a great story.
So that, Chuck, that is a real criticism of postmodernism.
Sure.
Because everything's meaning is up for grabs. It's up in the air. There's no universal truth. And if you can put meaning in air quotes as well, that means by proxy that everything is meaningless in a certain way of looking at it. And so, it's cool. That was an interesting thing, and it kind of was clever. But it is it as satisfying? Is it as meaningful as, like you said, a good novel? You know, like an actual novel that follows like maybe a little more structure or rules. Some people would say no, but a lot of people would say yes. And they would point to the idea that there's this kind of nihilistic bent in postmodernism in every form, whether it's visual art, film, novels, that makes it less important in a way. And again, I personally think it's because postmodernism was born as a repellent response to a long-standing thing, and that it was automatically born on shaky, reckless ground, and that how can you create something beautiful if you don't think there is such a thing as beauty? How can you create something meaningful if you don't think there is such a thing as meaning? And if there is no such thing as meaning, then stop writing, because you're just doing that for money now at this point.
Right, which I think was the goal-oriented movement of modern art. It didn't specifically say, but what else would the goal be?
Right.
Rather than to have a showing and sell paintings.
Yes.
Some of the other sort of elements of postmodern literature, one is paradox and randomness. Books like Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22, you started seeing... And even though there were nonlinear narratives before, you found stories that were really told out of order at this point, mm-hmm. and that even had facts that don't align with one another, where you might say, well, that doesn't even make sense sometimes, according to what I had previously read, like even earlier in the same book or chapter, mm-hmm. Sometimes purposefully obfuscating meaning or disorienting the reader. And then this whole idea of intertextuality, which is in like... sort of the mashup that David Byrne was talking about, but in this case with literature, incorporating plot lines and characters from other works or other tropes and literary ideas, kind of bringing them all into one book.
Yeah, like a good example of that is not found in literature, but in TV, in the character of John Munch, who's a detective, who started out as a detective on the TV show Homicide, Life on the Street. And then that same character appeared... on Law & Order SVU. He was a recurring longtime character on that show, right?
So is it the same actor?
Yes, same actor, same character.
Is this part of the St. Elsewhere universe theory?
Yes, yes. The Tommy Westfall universe. Yeah, John Munch is like one of the fulcrums of that universe.
Oh, wow.
Because he's also been on X-Files. He's also been on The Wire. Like, he's this character that people like love and love to bring into their own show, even though they had nothing to do with Homicide, Life on the Street. And so that's a really good example of intertextuality. This character keeps popping up in different works, and it's the same character. And in him appearing there, it's saying this show exists in the same universe as this show. And yes, you can all trace it back to the St. Elsewhere finale, which I think we talked about in our Nutso-Fan Theories episode.
Yeah, Tarantino does that a lot, too. Mm-hmm. With the Vega brothers, and I think that was...
Red Apple Cigarettes.
Yeah, and there was a character in Jackie Brown that was also in, I can't think of his name, one of the FBI guys. Michael Keaton played him in mm-hmm. Out of Sight. But I think that was a recurring character in different... Without any real sort of... it's not like, you know, Alfred from Batman appearing in different Batman movies. It's sort of out of context intertextuality, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And then also Tarantino is a good example of postmodernism as far as like pastiche, which is just such an obnoxious word. But once you look into it, it's basically just borrowing other styles and kind of in the postmodern sense, mashing them together. So Tarantino is like crazy about like 70s kung fu stuff or 70s gangster flicks.
Right.
And he would use those. He would actually take characters who were based on those other eras and those other styles and put them all into the same movie, into the same universe together. That's pastiche, and that's another very postmodern thing. Wes Anderson is another good example. His like just unparalleled love of mid-century like looks and design.
Yeah.
That's a pastiche. Although it turns out he's a post-postmodern director in almost every sense of the word.
Yeah. I mean, I think Pulp Fiction is very commonly referred to as sort of one of the hallmarks of postmodern filmmaking, in that not only the mashups, but the nonlinear storytelling, the good guys are bad guys are good guys, the sort of rejection of purpose, like, you know, what's in the briefcase. Mm-hmm. Like that's a very non, and I think that's why I never really cared that much, but I think it's why I drove a lot of people crazy, because as filmgoers, we're so trained to have to know what's in that briefcase because it should have some sort of meaning. And he was kind of turned it on its ear a little bit. And then everybody copied for the next decade Pulp Fiction. And there were so many bad sort of half ripoffs made.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say any. There's one I could call out, but I'm not going to.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Text it to me or something.
I will. But have you seen Severance on Apple TV?
Yeah, I'm about halfway through. I love it.
It's so good. That's like a good example of that, leaving people wanting more and just absolutely not giving it to them. Like, sorry. Yeah. There's no resolution. It's just crazy how strung out you feel after the last episode.
Oh, boy. I can't wait. All right. I think we should, we got to take our second break now.
Yeah, we definitely do.
We'll talk a little bit more about film and sum this all up, maybe.
Sure.
All right. We'll be right back.
All right. Game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Hey, everybody, if you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
All right, so Pulp Fiction is routinely singled out as a postmodern film. The one that's considered probably the godfather of all of them is 8 1/2 by Fellini, Federico Fellini. I've never seen it. Have you?
Yeah, sure. Godfather, not in the movie sense.
Right.
So we don't confuse everybody.
I think you planted that about 40 minutes ago.
I might have. Yeah, I've seen 8 1/2. It's, if you've taken any sort of film appreciation class in college, you're going to see it. It's Fellini's, you know, one of Fellini's masterpieces. The whole movie could be described as a metafiction because it's a film about making a film. Mm-hmm. It's really good. It's dreamy and trippy. And confusing. It's full of a lot of dream sequences, and reality and fiction are blurred. Highly recommend seeing 8 1/2, and then like reading a lot about it afterward.
I
so
love
you can
that.
Make sense about it.
That's one of my favorite types of movies. Is a movie that you can watch and then go find a bunch of like film crit on it.
Yeah,
that explains it or points it out. It just discusses it. I love that kind of thing.
I finally saw Casablanca, by the way.
Oh, great. What'd you think?
You know, I'm not going to say medium. it was really good. I would not put it among like the best films I've ever seen or ever made. But
even as a mainstream film?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was really, really good. But I definitely didn't see like, oh, my God, this is the best film I've ever seen type of feeling.
Yeah. I think people leave out that it's one of the best mainstream films ever made of the, you know, first half, the first half of the century, or the middle of the century, I would even expand it out to you. Right. I loved it. I think it's just a great movie. But
no, I'm really
glad
enjoyed
you saw
it
finally.
But it was, I think maybe the expectation. It's sort of like when I saw Citizen Kane for the first time after so much buildup. It really delivered on that as far as I think just breaking boundaries of filmmaking and raising the bar. And I don't feel like Casablanca did that. I thought it was kind of just a normal, really good movie.
Yeah. Very normal and mainstream, but
yeah.
A good one. Agreed. So, 8 1/2. It's like you said. It's a meta narrative, basically. And anytime you see something like dreamy or weird, or people play themselves or strange versions of themselves, you have stumbled into a postmodern film. A really good example of that is basically everything Charlie Kaufman's ever written or directed.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Like Synecdoche, New York is probably one of the most postmodern films ever made. But then also, so is like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But people are like, this is not truly postmodern in every sense. But it checks enough boxes that you could say that's definitely a postmodern film. Same with being John Malkovich.
Yeah,
that's
an
super
adaptation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the currency he deals in.
Mm-hmm.
I still haven't seen the most recent one with Jesse Plemons. I got to check that out.
I'm thinking of Ending Things.
Yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think so. I saw the Nicolas Cage movie that's coming out.
I ended up at
a screener.
Was it good?
It is very good, but it's very postmodern too. Like Nicolas Cage plays himself, and it's just completely off the rails from time to time. And in a lot of ways, it reminded me of Adaptation, where it like purposefully goes off the rails to like make a point, like Adaptation did. And so it borrowed from that, and it didn't, you know, it certainly seemed that way even more because Nicolas Cage is in it. But it's pretty good movie. It's worth seeing for sure.
And, you know, shout out while we're off track. I just saw the Nicolas Cage movie Pig.
Oh, yeah.
From last year. about a former chef who is a truffle hunter. Mm-hmm. And is trying to find his pig. And stuff you should know, listener, I believe, because he was a Movie Crush listener, mm-hmm. Michael Sarnowski directed that movie.
Oh, neat. I've heard good things about it.
It's fantastic.
That's awesome.
It's really, really good. So
I will definitely check it out then.
All right. Let's wrap this up, I guess. Should we talk about, I don't know, criticisms?
Sure. Also, we just need to definitely give a shout out. Postmodernism and architecture is also a thing.
Frank Gehry.
Right. It's almost its own track, but it had an even more abrupt change than, say, like film or art did. Like, it's just, it went from minimalist functional design to just take everything apart, tear it down, and put it back together in weird ways. And yeah, Frank Gehry is the embodiment of the postmodern star architect, is what they call him.
Yeah, and I think if you want a good example, if you want to look at modern versus postmodern, you can look at the two Guggenheims from Frank Lloyd Wright in New York to Gehry's in Spain. Mm-hmm. I was just in New York and went to the Guggenheim and saw the Kandinsky exhibit. Highly recommend going to that before it closes.
Nice.
Or anything at the Guggenheim, because just being in that building is quite an experience.
Still have never been.
Oh, my God. You're kidding.
No.
It's the best one.
It's the best Guggenheim?
It's my favorite museum in the world.
Really?
Yeah, because you're in and out in a couple of hours. It's not intimidating. You just ascend up that circular ramp and see a lot of great art over a couple of hours, and then you're out of there. And the building itself is art.
Very nice. Well, I'll check it out.
It's like going to the Met is intimidating. The Guggenheim is not intimidating.
I'm going to get super efficient and watch Pig and go to the Guggenheim in the same day.
Totally should. Go to New York. Don't watch a movie in New York. Watch it on the plane.
There you go. I have to really select my airline carefully.
All right. So criticisms of postmodernism. Like you said, it is a bit of a punching bag these days, and maybe kind of always has been. But you have people from both sides of the political spectrum criticizing postmodernism, whether it's sort of the old school leftists who think like, no, it has nothing to do with social progress. All this individualism is no good for our movement. To conservatism?
Mm-mm.
Conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
Which is we do not like this whole there is no right or wrong, it's all about your perspective things, because right. There is definitely right and wrong, everybody.
Yes, like how can you ban a book when it's not demonstrably wrong for asserting a viewpoint that's outside the norm, you know?
That's a very good point.
Yeah, so of course they don't like the idea of moral relativism. But I was surprised that the leftists thought that until I learned that Léotard himself was basically like, yeah, this is a strange new unhappy direction that we're going in, and they laid it at the feet of the failure of Marxism to kind of bring about like collective social progress, and then
right.
The response to that was Thatcher's and Reagan's neoliberal policies that basically said deregulate everything, make as much money as you can at the expense of whoever you need to, and let's go global, baby, and that is part and parcel with postmodernism as far as economics is concerned. And if you're an economist and a philosopher and you're looking at postmodernism, probably to you, late capitalism and postmodernism are basically interchangeable words.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why so many people are so sick of postmodernism, because there isn't anything right. There isn't anything wrong. There is no truth. There is no morality. It's just... just get as rich as you can is a huge part of it, too. The commodification of art really kind of laid the groundwork for that, and it's permeated everywhere, right? So now people say, okay, we're sick of postmodernism. We think it's dead. What's next? So, Chuck, what is next after postmodernism?
Well, I certainly don't know, but you sent along some interesting reading for me to ponder. Mm-hmm. And the general thought is that we are in an era now of, and again, it won't be probably defined until 10 to 20 years later, but hypermodernism, which is what this article calls postmodernism on steroids, where advertising is art and where tech companies are the governments of the world, or at least as influential as the governments of the world and the religions of the world. or meta-modernism, which is not quite hyper-modernism, right? It's sort of hearkening back to modernism.
Yes, but with the advantage of having seen the failures of modernism before and then having lived through postmodernism. So it's this idea that there is such a thing as beauty and truth and nature, and that they are important and they matter and they're things we should move towards, and that we should be positive and inclusive. So Ted Lasso is like a cartoonish embodiment of meta-modernism.
Yeah.
And we see this clash going on right now, Chuck. Like, there's a huge clash in, like, every kind of culture war. It's between people who are saying, like, no, we need to keep extracting and consuming, and other people are like, no, we need to go a different track and, like, say, save the planet or whatever. And some philosophers say this is the split that postmodernism kind of broke into, and right now we're figuring out which direction we're going to go in, you know, save the planet, ruin the planet. Like, that kind of black and white choice is basically being laid out for us right now, and that's our place in history. And no one has any idea which one's going to win out, although some people say hypermodernism already has. Like, we're just too much slaves to our devices, and we've just been co-opted by technology too deeply already to get ourselves out of it. Other people say not so fast, including Ted Lasso.
Well, all of the stuff that you sent me about meta-modernism made me finally understand one of my favorite singer, country artist Sturgill Simpson's first record was called Meta-Modern Sounds in Country Music. Hmm. And now that title makes more sense to me than it ever did, because he is a country singer who sort of defies the modern country singing movement by hearkening back to another time. He's you know, like a progressive liberal country singer, so that doesn't go over well in a lot of circles of country music.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
I think so.
Like when he got COVID and he was sort of speaking out about it, I was reading Fox News comments about this, and people were like, who even is this guy? He's no country star. I've never even heard of him.
Like, Field dressed him like a deer.
That's because they don't play him on modern country music stations because he doesn't sing about tailgating. But his first record is called Meta Modern Sounds in Country Music, and it's fantastic. He sounds like a mashup of Waylon Jennings and George Jones, if that tells you where he's coming from.
Dude, how could you go wrong with that?
Exactly.
With a little bit of Joan Baez thrown in.
Yeah, why not?
So Sturgill Simpson is possibly the future, or Bitcoin mining is the other future. It's our choice, everybody. Who knows where we'll end up, but we'll find out.
All right. So that was postmodern. Scratched the surface.
Yeah, we did. And that's the stuff you should know way. If you want to know more about postmodernism, there's a lot to go read about it. There's a lot to read about hypermodernism, metamodernism, post-postmodernism. It's really, really interesting rabbit holes to go down. You can make a hobby out of it. And since I said you can make a hobby out of it, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to follow this up. This was about the short stuff about nose breathing, and that you got a toothache from nose breathing.
Mm-hmm.
This is from a, quote, qualified dentist working in the UK.
Nice.
Named Tom Park. Hey, guys. I'll kind of skip the greetings for length, but he goes on to say the maxillary. The maxillary sinuses, usually referred to just as the sinuses, sit next to the nose, about in the region of your upper cheeks, and extend to the front of your face on either side of the nose. They're very close to the ends of the roots of your molars, premolars, and sometimes canines, where all the nerves supplying your teeth enter those teeth. When you have sinusitis, this can feel like a toothache even a couple weeks after the blocked nose symptoms have settled. And lots of people come to the dentist around wintertime with toothaches, which is ultimately put down to this phenomenon.
Oh, man.
I had it myself once, and the jog I went on was agonizing, and my empathy for my patients grew considerably.
That's nice.
This can also occur when you breathe in very cold air through your nose, if that air then goes into the sinuses, but it's usually more transient. I hope this helps. Perhaps Josh should check with his own dentist to see if he has cavities that need managing.
Well, this was like a decade or so ago. What's the dentist's name? The qualified dentist?
Tom Park.
Thank you, Tom. This was at least, no, this is probably more like, oh my God, 20 years ago when it happened, thankfully.
Oh,
and
okay.
I definitely did have a cavity that needed to be filled back there. But I went to the dentist recently, Chuck, and get this.
Yeah.
My dentist said that she's going to need to raise my sinus. And I was like, how do you raise a sinus? She said, well, they used to do it with the hammer and chisel. We still got the hammer and chisel, but we have a better way of doing it now that's less painful. But they used to go in and put like a chisel up under like your sinus and then tap it and actually raise your sinus. It sounds medieval.
Are you going to do it?
To quote Pulp Fiction. Yeah, I'm going to have to because I need like a little bit of bone put back there and they can't do it without raising the sinus.
Oh, man.
I'll keep you posted.
I'll be without my tooth, man. What's going on with us?
I don't know. Like, we were genetically conferred with terrible teeth, I think.
And by the way, Tom Park also says, by the way, also your description of the audience in Manchester who didn't clap until the very end made me laugh out loud. As a man, CUNY and myself, I can tell you that we are not easily impressed. So good on you for earning that clap. And that
yeah.
is from dentist Tom Park. Go to Tom Park if you're anywhere in the UK, you should make that trip to see Tom.
He's got the empathy.
It's right.
He loves Ted Lasso.
Loves.
If you want to be like Tom Park and write in about something we talked about, we love that kind of stuff. When somebody comes back and crosses a T or dots an I or adds an ellipse even, although we don't like the ellipses that much. And you can put that all into an email.
Yeah.
And send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month. Hey, everybody, if you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours, too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
Childproofing people's homes is hard. But Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.